So here we are. And to the members and board of Peace Action, thank you for this opportunity to address you on this important occasion of 25 years of work for peace and social justice. We're at a moment in human history which could be very dispiriting, because we see this impulse towards war gathering strength. Despite all of our ardent efforts, we see nations taking up against nations. We see world leaders who beat the drums of war. We see legislatures swept up into war talk. We see national budgets, particularly our own, keep growing for armaments and cut, budgets cut for housing, for healthcare, for job creation, for the environment, for senior citizen programs, for veterans. And we see the world moving in a direction of destruction. It's not simply global warming that represents a destruction to the global climate, but it is global warring as well. And so we're called upon to respond. And the way that we respond is particularly important. So much of the peace movement has been marginalized, I believe, not because of the media, but because the inflection that we use, because of the direction that we take, actually ends up creating the opposite of that which it is we hope to achieve. Let me explain what I mean. When we stand for peace, we understand that peace is not just the absence of war. Peace is the active presence of a capacity for growth, for nurturance, for compassion, for reaching out, for seeing the world as one, for understanding that the world is interconnected and it is interdependent. When we stand for peace, we stand for a self-sustaining and affirming principle which holds up the world. So the peace movement, when it focuses on those powerful energies, has the potential for tremendous growth. On the other hand, when we focus on being simply against war, we come into polarity. Peace comes into polarity with war. And somehow we find ourselves forever at the polar opposite of war. This capacity for polarization is something that we need to study, because the us versus them, whoever they are, reflects a kind of thinking, a dichotomized thinking, that inevitably leads to war, and it enforces war. So there is a paradox then in being anti-war, because you can be anti-war and actually keep war going. And we need to remember that. And I speak not as someone who is a lecturer on this, but as someone who cares passionately about seeing a mass movement for peace develop in this country and mature in this country. I think we're on the threshold of that. And I think we're on the threshold of merging with people all over the world who are rejecting this idea of the inevitability of war. Elizabeth and I, this past Tuesday, were in London, where I spoke to what is known as the People's Congress, representatives from all over the UK, who were present and supported by 50 members of the Parliament in organizing in their own communities for peace action, for programs that relate to addressing violence in their own communities, and for an insistence that a national policy be developed that commits the UK to the path of peace. It was really amazing to see 1,000 people together in Westminster Center Hall, to see this belief that even if the government isn't responding, that people still have a right to not just speak their dreams, but by their very presence, pronounce the existence of peace. Think of what it means when through our presence, we take a stand. And we say we're for peace, that we're for connecting with other people of other races, colors, creeds, that we're for finding the humanity that exists in every living being and not rejecting them for ideological or political purposes. Peace is not simply a flat world statement. It is an animating principle of human existence, which recognizes a fundamental truth of human existence. And that is what I would call the imperative of human unity. We must insist that all governments affirm this principle of human unity, of taking active steps that build the capacity of people to be able to affirm our connection to one another. That was what the creation of the United Nations was all about. It was understanding the imperative of human unity. The creation of the United States itself was not simply about the gathering of 13 colonies, and then later on, today, 50 states. It was, in effect, a statement of a celebration of human unity, not simply the unity of states. The first motto of the United States, in Latin, e pluribus unum, translated, out of many, one, speaks to the imperative of human unity, because it is in recognizing our commonalities, not only as citizens of the same country, but as citizen diplomats of the world. In recognizing our commonalities, we come to understand the immanent power of the human heart and the capacity we have to elevate the human condition so that the human spirit, and indeed the spirit of the world, can be so present in a way that is so powerful for peace that war would be unthinkable. This is the ultimate path of peace action. This is the path that extends from our consciousness, from every thought that we have, from rejection of fear, from a desire to acting upon the desire to connect with others. This is a process that understands the unity of thought, word, and deed, knowing that our words have extensional power, that they create reality, that our words, peace, have the ability to change the world, knowing that our deeds matter, knowing that the act of each individual makes a difference. You of Peace Action know these secrets, but we need to share them with the world. We need to let the world know at this time that peace is inevitable, that war is not inevitable, because we're prepared to set in place structures for peace, for recognizing mutuality. This is one of the animating principles behind the proposal to create a cabinet-level department of peace, where we look at peace as being something that we actually teach our children, where we teach children peace-giving, peace-sharing, mutuality, looking at the other person as an aspect of oneself. We're taught by our spiritual training that whatever we do for the least of the brethren, we do for the Lord, or through that Lord, are the highest expression of ourselves. We're taught to love our neighbor as ourselves, not because our neighbor is something other than ourselves, but because our neighbor is ourselves. It's the creation of the other that puts us in a position where we are stuck. And indeed, that's where we are in the world today. Because of the creation of the other, we attacked Iraq. Because of the creation of people as other, there are those who would rattle sabers against Iran or Syria. What is this destructive capacity that causes us to abandon an even higher power that exists within us? I would contend it's fear. It's this belief that unless we defend ourselves against some anonymous, anomalous force, that we ourselves will be destroyed. Fear is connected directly to a lack of faith. Again, we know from our spiritual teachings, we cannot walk in faith and fear at the same time. So it takes a tremendous amount of faith to stand for peace. We know that faith has a creative capacity, so has the spirit. We create that which we desire. We bring to us that which we desire. Faith is the ability to look at the unseen, to name it, and to call it forth, and to make it real. Each of us has that capacity. We may not be able to experience peace as a country today, but I tell you that if we have real faith in America, we will believe that this country has the capacity to once again be the leaders in peace, to visualize it, to see it, to name it, call it forward, and make that what our country is about. It really is time for us to once again examine the purpose of nationhood. That when our founders came together and cited the preamble to the Constitution, providing for the common defense was only one purpose. And so many of the other purposes that have been fundamental, foundational purposes of the United States have been rejected. In a sense, we're called upon to redraft this preamble and to make part of the foundational purpose of this country the creation of a culture of peace. And that's exactly what the creation of a Department of Peace is all about. It is time that America understood that our work is not simply abroad. Our work is in our own nation to address the problems and the challenges of domestic violence, spousal abuse, child abuse, violence in the school, racial violence, violence against gays, police community clashes, and you do that with compassion, we do that with love for each other, but we do that. And we do that with education, we do that with the support of the government, but we do that. We do not point our finger at our brother or sister, we look at our own hearts and our own capacity and forgive ourselves for violence that we have sanctioned, but realize that we have the potential to create once again a nation of which it will be said in the future, they rebuilt that shining city on a hill and they gave it a name of peace. And they gave it a name of peace. So what is the timetable for peace? It is now. It's not in a year. It's not in 2 years. It's not when a new president takes the oath of office. The timetable for peace in America is now. That's why 4 days ago when the House of Representatives voted to continue to fund the war, I took a stand and I said, no, you cannot say you're for peace and vote to fund a war. We need to take a new direction. And I want to thank Congressman McNulty for his vote as well. We need to recreate this moment and tap our capacities to take a new direction. And this is not just about me. I'm traveling this country. And indeed, in traveling the world, I see this hunger for peace. I see this hunger for the confirmation of human unity. Last week at this time, Elizabeth and I were on a diplomatic mission to Geneva, Paris, and London, where we met with diplomats, representatives of national governments, parliamentarians. This hunger for peace is worldwide. We're at a moment of dynamic tension where the principle of war and peace are really struggling with each other. We all understand this. And the question is, where do we stand? In the Hindu religion, it's said that the forces of Shiva and Vishnu exist simultaneously, that destruction and creation are side by side. Well then, we get a chance to choose which channels through us every moment. Peace action, and the participants in it understand this. But I will tell you that more than ever, we must take this stand. More than ever, we must not let government officials present us with false alternatives or limited options, because it's not a choice in Iraq, for example, between whether we stay at war
to, the choice should be, we should end the war now. We should end it now. It's not... The choice isn't what kind of sanctions we should have for Iran, or if we should bomb Iran. The choice should be to engage in diplomacy with Iran and engage them in the international community. The choice should not be to let interest groups describe the Middle Eastern policy of the United States, but to have the United States play an honest broker to finally bring peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. That's something that is absolutely critical. The choice is not simply at what rate do you build up nuclear weapons, or at what rate do you build down nuclear weapons, but the choice should be, how soon can you abolish nuclear weapons? We're presented with narrow choices. We're not being presented with the alternatives that sustain our country, and that then becomes peace actions work. To demand that the parameters of choice be expanded, to not go along with the insistence of government officials, well, this is the best we can do. War should never be the best we can do. If war is the best we can do, then the people who are saying that should be removed from office, period. Peace is the best we can do. How do we bring peace to Iraq? H.R. 1234 is a piece of legislation that I wrote with the help of individuals in the international community who have long been active in developing peacekeeping security forces that moved in to help stabilize areas that were at war. So when I looked at the situation in Iraq, I knew and know there has to be an alternative to what's going on. The alternative isn't increased occupation, as this administration wants to continue. The United States must end the occupation of Iraq. The occupation is fueling the insurgency. Everyone knows this. So, but when you end the occupation, what do you do to stabilize Iraq? What do you do to provide security for the Iraqi people? I asked that question of individuals at the UN. People have been involved in peacekeeping and security programs for 20 years, let's say. And with their help, I crafted a piece of legislation that provides the following. Stop the funding for the war, make sure that we end the occupation, close the bases, bring the troops home, set in motion a parallel process that involves the international community. We will not have the international community involved until we declare that we're going to stop these policies that result in an occupation. But once we take that new direction, and at some point America will have to take that new direction, the international community will respond, they're ready to respond. The nations of the region are ready to respond. We have to engage diplomatically with Iran and Syria as we do this, but we can put together a peacekeeping and security force that moves in as our troops move out. That will then set the stage for the stabilization of Iraq. It won't stabilize it in and of itself, but it will begin the process of stopping the conflict that resulted from the occupation, from the invasion and the occupation. As we do that, when the United States leaves, then the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds will have the opportunity for a real process of reconciliation. Today, the U.S. presence really doesn't permit that. We're protecting a Shiite government, which is really involved in revenge against Sunnis. And that process will continue as long as the U.S. is there. We have to move out as the international peacekeepers move in. Process of reconciliation between Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds with the help of the international community. A process, an honest process of reconstruction where the people of Iraq will be able to see their country rebuilt. We broke it, we're gonna have to pay for it. We have to also provide reparations for the families who lost loved ones. We have a moral obligation. We're told we must be repairers of the breach. That's our spiritual teaching. We must be repairers of the breach. We created a breach with the invasion, illegal occupation, the destruction of Iraq, and over 650,000 innocent civilians have lost their lives. We have much repair to do. But when we work on that repairing, will feel this stigma and the stain that this war has left on our nation begin to be lifted. It is a moral obligation which we have. We also have an obligation to give full control to the Iraqi people of their oil assets. Do you know this bill that passed a few days ago had as a cardinal provision forcing Iraq to pass a hydrocarbon law which sets the stage for the privatization of the Iraq oil industry and for the profit of U.S. oil interests. And this was passed by Democrats, okay? So I'm saying that in no way should we be in any position of trying to force Iraq to enter into agreements that would let oil, private oil interests capitalize the oil of Iraq. That we went into Iraq, I believe, principally, to grab their oil. We're threatening Iran, principally, to grab their oil. This is a government which really has been involved in criminal activity with respect to prosecuting war against innocent people in order to grab their resources. We have to put an end to that. We can't reward it. We cannot reward it. The Iraqis stabilize their energy and food prices. Their prices have gone up. People can't afford to feed their families. We have to make sure that when Iraq eventually will qualify for loans from the international community, that the country not be put under the structural adjustment burdens of the IMF or the World Bank that will keep the country under the thumb of international finance for years to come. We have to make sure that this plan, HR 1234, not only has a chance to be heard, but that it's a template that can be used to transition the United States away from the condition we find ourselves in, the path that we've taken in Iraq. In closing, I'd like to present you with this thought. We've taken a very difficult voyage this country has since 9/11. We've plunged deeply into fear, into polarization, into war, to separating ourselves from the world community. We know that America's gone such a great distance from the country that we love, from the country that we've been so proud to be part of. And we know that America can be so much more. But the only way that America's going to be so much more is if we insist on truth, is if we insist on peace. Because never before have we seen so directly connected truth and peace. We know that the war against Iraq was based on lies. We know that the continuation of the war and funding the war was based on lies. We know the desire of the United States to maintain a presence in that region is based on lies. We know the attempt to try to build a case for war against Iran is based on lies. We know this idea that the Palestinians and the Israelis can never work out a peace agreement is based on lies. We know that we have the capacity to have peace equate with truth. We will tell the truth. The truth will set the United States free. It will free it in 2008. From a politics dedicated to death and destruction. It will free it beyond that and cause our nation to reintegrate with the world community, to sign the Kyoto Climate Change Treaty, to join the International Criminal Court, to abolish all nuclear weapons, to participate in the Biological Weapons Convention, the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Small Arms Treaty, the Landmine Treaty. We are on the threshold of rejoining the world community in the cause of peace, of reaching out across the miles and engaging our brothers and sisters of different languages, different colors, different creeds, different races, and recognizing them as ourselves, in seeing them as our brothers and sisters, and in celebrating human unity. We're right there, and peace action is going to help lead the way. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. wanted to take some questions, and listen, I'm from the government, I don't take questions. Of course, I'd love to hear any of your questions. David, has everyone eaten here, by the way? Okay, fine. The last thing I want to do is be taking questions with hungry people here. Yes, let's start there. I thank you, because that, and obviously, in my remarks, there's going to be questions, because I didn't address everything, but let me respond to your point. First of all, with respect to the Military Commissions Act, I can tell you that after I take the office of president, that Military Commission Act comes down. That's just the Patriot Act. We have to, I know what Congress passed, but I'm telling you, the president is the one that has to execute the laws. And I'm saying that the Military Commissions Act and the Patriot Act are set aside, and anybody who's in prison, there is such a thing as habeas corpus. And that people do have a right. And that right has been trashed. And it's a central right to a democratic society. We're going to reinstate that right for people to be able to gain their legal status in courts of law, to be able to told what the charges are against them. And if they're not charged in an expeditious way, they have to be released. That's the American way. And we're going to remind people what America's always been about. That's how we'll become great again. Yes. In the back, standing up. Here's what's going on. What's happening is very cynical in Washington, because we've blown up Iraq, we've invaded and occupied the country, and as you say, killed a lot of innocent civilians. And now we're telling Iraqis, stand up on your feet, for God's sake. What's wrong with you? You don't have a lawful country. Why, shape up, or we're leaving. What a deal. Look, this situation is so convoluted. And it reminds me of a line in the Bible that says, that which is crooked cannot be made straight. Nothing about Iraq that comes out of this administration, and it appears out of some of my beloved colleagues, will ever be made straight, because it starts from the premise that the war somehow was right. This war's wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong from the beginning. And many members knew that. And some are saying, well, they're sorry, fine, except for one thing. The ones who are saying they're sorry and they want to be president of the United States, the biggest question you have to answer when you're president of the United States is, do you commit to young men and women in this country into combat? And you've got to show that you have the wisdom and judgment to make that call. Mm-hmm. We're right now at a point where Congress is blaming the Iraqi people for the conditions in Iraq. And so I say that this is still another reason why we have to take a path which recognizes the difficulties that we've created for the Iraqi people. None of that discussion took place, by the way, in the debate the other day. As a matter of fact, the only way I got a chance to get into the debate was to get a minute from the Republicans. I'm telling you, I mean, this is the kind of, our party is becoming so insular in thinking that somehow we're going to give a Democratic version of the war, and that's going to be superior to the Republican version of the war. War shouldn't be a partisan issue. We have to go way beyond that. We need to reconnect with our own hearts and tell the truth. The truth is the war is based on lies. And when you stand on that truth, you realize that we can't get out of Iraq fast enough, and we can't engage the international community fast enough, and we also need to make sure that the individuals in the administration who were involved in sending us into war based on those lies are held to accountability, to fulfill the laws of this nation and the laws of the international community.
What specific steps can the United States take to bring about a real peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Elizabeth and I were in the Middle East last July, August, and we met with Israeli officials and Palestinian officials and people in both communities. The United States needs to establish itself as an honest broker, not take one side against the other. The only way we can help resolve it is to be available to both sides, to be compassionate listeners to both sides, to understand that it's true, both sides have suffered. And we need to recognize that. But we also need to take a deep look at the kind of suffering that has been created for the Palestinians while the United States has stayed on the sidelines. You know, we saw the walls and the checkpoints and the kind of humiliation that has been exacted there. We also talk to Israelis who are truly concerned about what they call an existential threat, that and they have every right to be concerned about, will Israel be able to survive? Well, the fact of the matter is, this administration's policies have not been, in my estimation, very friendly to Israel. They've actually endangered Israel, put Israel at a point of maximum exposure. Instead of engaging in diplomacy, we've gone on the war path, we've created war. That destabilized the whole world and makes it more difficult to bring about a settlement in the Middle East. The policies in the Middle East cannot be divorced from the policies in the wider circumference. And so by getting out of Iraq, by taking a new direction, ending policies of unilateralism, first strike, preemption, the United States then has the moral authority to be able to engage the parties in the Middle East and once again begin to construct a process of peace. I think we can do that. But we can do it with leadership that isn't afraid, and with leadership that's not bought, and leadership that has the ability to speak out, and I'm ready to do that. Look at that issue, because I think moments ago I talked to you about how when you stand for peace, we can't put ourselves in as anti-war. That anti-war brings to us war. I think it's very important how we address this issue of impeachment. That is there anger out there about what's happened in the country? Yes, we have to recognize that. But in a way, we have to go way past that anger. Because if impeachment is something that's fueled by anger, it will only result in the unraveling of our country. Impeachment fueled by anger is a dangerous thing. But impeachment fueled by a love of our country, by a desire for those who are in high office to live by their oath of office, to faithfully defend and execute the laws of the United States, that kind of a process could be very healing for America. So we have to, this goes beyond the individuals involved. I try to stay out of polarity with the individuals involved. But we do have a president and a vice president who have conducted themselves in a certain way that I think, as I indicated on my website at kucinich.us last week, that it's time to start having a discussion nationally about the appropriate course of action to take. Some of our Democratic leaders have said, no, we shouldn't even talk about this. I think that's a mistake because Congress has a responsibility to be a check and balance to the abuse of administrative power. That's what the Constitution set up. And if we don't do that, that's at the peril of the people. Now, you know, you have to be aware of people who will come to you and start ripping the president apart, ripping the vice president apart, because what that does is that comes from the wrong place. I'm going to respectfully suggest that comes from the wrong place. And I'm not a rookie in politics. I started my career, Frank, 40 years ago. I was a city councilman, a clerk of courts, a mayor of Cleveland, state senator, U.S. congressman. And let me tell you something, you've got to be very careful if you're going to use that process, how you pursue it. So I say we need the national discussion right now. The tone of the discussion is very important. It should be serious. It should be fact-based. It should be based on the laws. And it should look to the laws as a guidance as to how we proceed. But I am insisting that we not put that in a position where we say, well, we can't talk about it. So we are going to talk about it. And I would urge you to stay in touch with that website at Kucinich.us, because when I gave that call out to people from around the country, we heard from, I think, over 100,000 people who had things they wanted to say about what the direction we're taking. But the tone has to be a high tone. It has to be one coming in from love of country. And it has to be one that whose aim is reconciliation. Yes, sir.
Is there a chance that we can get a real investigation of the events of September 11th? We had a commission that was controlled by the administration. We wouldn't have had any commission at all if it hadn't been for the families of the members and pressured it. And is there any chance we can have a commission that isn't afraid to look into the evidence of the administration being involved?
The answer to your question is yes, and let me tell you how. I'm now the chair of the Domestic Policy Committee of the Congress. It has very broad jurisdiction. It's a subcommittee, rather. And our subcommittee, I've already announced that our subcommittee will be looking at some significant, although narrowly defined, issues related to 9/11. We don't have the budget to have the kind of a full-blown review that the commission had. However, there are some fairly egregious disparities that have existed in the stories that the commission accepted. And I'm focusing in on some of them. I would just tell you to stay tuned. I'm not ready to talk about it publicly, but I will say that our committee will hold hearings on specific issues that relate to 9/11. And if there's anyone here that's really working on that very carefully, I would urge you to stay in touch with my office in Washington, because we are going to get into it. Again, this idea of things being off the table and matters being closed, I don't think so. Yes, sir, in fact.
Do you think the United States is also standing on the sidelines in Darfur? And if so, what do you feel about it being immoral?
Well, you know, we well, of course, the events in Darfur, which have resulted in widespread death and starvation, are immoral. When the United States forfeits its moral standing in the world, there's a lot of innocent people who are going to die all over the globe. Our adventure in Iraq has already cost us in excess of $600 billion. According to Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, we'll spend between $1 and $2 trillion in Iraq. We're looking at a military budget of $600 billion in the next fiscal year. So meanwhile, Darfur, political violence, dislocation, systems that would be used to distribute food and water, falling apart, people just in utter despair. We're on the sidelines because we're preoccupied with something that's totally wrong. And we lack the moral authority to be able to engage the world community. I mean, that's a fact. You know, as we travel the globe, we see that the great concern that people have about what's happened to America, the same surprise that we've had in the last 5 years, where we say, I can't believe this has happened in the United States, is reflected in the world community. We need to engage directly and immediately in Darfur. But the reason why we can't is that we're looking at other military adventures. And frankly, there's you know, there's a hint of racism to that policy. There's a hint of if Darfur had the kind of oil resources that Iraq and Iran had, we'd be there. We know that. If the people had great wealth that could somehow be used to send back here, we'd probably work out a way to get there. But we're talking about essentially poor people. I want to see the United States be an exemplar and a moral force in the world again. And the way that we do that is to stop war and to use the resource of the United States to help lift people up. Not just to look at where there's poverty and war that exists, but to look at where there's disease, AIDS, and other things, and to use the resources we have. We're such a wealthy country, and we have an obligation to the world community. But as long as we remain at war, we're not able to exercise our real capacity. And as long as we are in a legal war, we're forfeiting it. I'd like to see us take the leadership again. It is a great tragedy in Darfur, and I regret that our nation has not done what it needs to do to relieve the suffering of the people. Yes. Yes. The question relates to destruction of the rainforest and a trade embargo with Brazil. I think that what we need to do is look at the international corporations that are involved in stripping the rainforest. And I would favor a change in international trade laws. One of the big tragedies of NAFTA and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, was that the trade rules were written without any concern for workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles. So what will I do about that? One of my first acts in office is going to be to reset the pointer of our trade policies. The fact that our trade policies are devoid of these principles I talked about doesn't mean that we can't put them back in. So here's what I intend to do. I intend to cancel NAFTA and go back to bilateral trade, conditioned on workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles. That way, Brazil then has to have a different relationship with its own environmental decisions. That way, every country in the world that wants to do business with the United States has to show a capacity and a willingness to be able to protect workers' rights and human rights. Workers' rights, the right to organize, the right to collective bargaining, the right to strike, those have to be fundamental in trade agreements. Human rights, prohibitions on slave labor, prison labor, child labor, that should be in trade agreements. Environmental quality principles, protection of the rainforest, protection of the air and the water and the land has to be written into these trade agreements. Before NAFTA, we had bilateral trade. Before NAFTA, we had the chance to be able to say what those principles guiding our trade would be. After NAFTA, corporate power took over, sank our aspirations to lift up the world, and used trade as a vehicle to redistribute the wealth of the world upwards. Trade should be a way to have all people share in the wealth of the world. And that's what human rights and social justice and economic justice are all about. Can I answer your question? Okay, yes.
Mr. Congressman, I don't know if you had a chance to read the funnies this morning.
You're talking about the front page of the New York Times?
I'm a great fan of all of this. When you made his cartoon this morning, you say you won't tell any publicity is good for this. And you were kind of filthy you for having only 2% of the vote. I worked on your campaign in 2004, and one of the great frustrations to me was the lack of coverage that you got on the evening news. And everybody else has.
Well, first, First of all, there was a poem that was written 35 years ago that began with these lines: "The revolution will not be televised." Okay, so that's the first thing I want you to remember. Now, I'll tell you what I see happening. I see the aspirations of the American people to take a new direction becoming so powerful that people are starting to question the media's own lack of willingness to be able to ask the deeper questions. Let's face it, the New York Times fell down on the job with respect to Iraq. When I went into an editorial board meeting at the New York Times in the last campaign, I mean, the level of arrogance was insufferable, and it was like, well, people just know more. You know, that's because they're with the New York Times. And I laid out all the reasons why the war was wrong. And, oh, no, we know better. Judith Miller, blah, blah, blah. Well, let me tell you something. Yeah, right. All the news, that's what? So, first of all, we have to be wise consumers. This isn't about them. It's about us. Our responsibility for being wise consumers of information. Secondly, those who are interested in helping the campaign need to be engaged with your local community media and let them know, because this is the only time I'm going to be in this area. It's to make sure that people know about what happened, what was said, what the significance of it happens to be, and why this has the potential to change America. Because what I see happening is this: the demand for peace is going to keep building, just as it built in 2006 and resulted in a new Congress. It's going to build in 2008. It's going to demand a president who has rejected war right from the beginning, and who has a vision of uniting the world in the cause of peace. I think we're pushing that direction. Another thing that needs to be done is organizing and helping to get that message out. I mean, that's essential. It's one thing to say, well, cover us. It's another thing to go and do the actual work door to door and organize people in the neighborhood around principles of peace and health care for all. By the way, another cardinal principle of this campaign for president is saying that it is time to break the hold that the insurance companies have in our healthcare system and have universal single payer, not for profit healthcare. Medicare for all. So I want to ask you to think about this. What happens when we go into our communities and organize for peace? Real. I mean, not just abstract. Don't let people tell you peace is impractical. If you want to see something impractical, look at this war in Iraq, right? I mean, let's talk about it. We're talking about practical politics here. It's practical to stand for peace, and it's practical to stand for health care for all. Now, in this campaign, there are, you know, we're peace action. Well, I would say peace and health care are pretty close together, too. With a nurse at my right-hand side here, there's proof. So think about this. Everyone running for president is for
universal health care.
Oh, really? You hear that? No matter where you go in 2008 in this election, people will smile and say, therefore,
universal health care.
Do you know what? Even the insurance companies are for universal health care. What a deal! Because they get to make sure that the government subsidizes the private insurance companies, who then raise premiums, co-pays, and deductibles and drive the whole country into poverty.
Universal health care.
Indeed. This issue of health care in America is the single most important domestic economic issue next to peace, because the private for-profit health care industry now takes 31% out of every dollar, $2.2 trillion a year spent on health care, $660 billion a year goes for corporate profits, stock options, executive salaries, advertising, marketing, the cost of paperwork, 15 to 30%, compared to Medicare's 3%. If we took that $660 billion each year, put it into health care for all, we would have enough to cover every health care need in this country, plus dental care, vision care,
mental health care, prescription drugs, and long-term care. It is time to break the shackles which the insurance companies have placed on our politics by positioning presidential candidates who say, well, you know, it's just not feasible for us to be able to have a single-payer system. It's not going to happen politically. I mean, it's not going to happen politically, okay? It's just not going to happen politically. This is what's happening. Our politics have been captured by these insurance companies. These candidates go to Wall Street and raise tons of money from hedge funds who are heavily involved in insurance transactions. And candidates then come back to the people and say, gee, I don't think we're going to be able to do this. Let's do something else, like have government subsidize the insurance industry. What a brilliant idea. Like government subsidize the pharmaceutical industry with Bush under Medicare Part D. The Democrats are doing the same thing. We're going to change that. We're going to make a national movement to have the American people have health care. We're going to end for-profit health care in America. We're going to help the American families be able to lift itself up. Stop the bankruptcies and foreclosures that are happening because of the high cost of health care. This is a transcending issue in this country, and I wanted to mention it here today because this is an issue whose time has come, and these candidates who tell the American people, well, they can do war, but they can't do not-for-profit health care, I'm ready to challenge them. I'm ready to challenge them with everything I have, and I'm ready to take my aspirations all the way to the White House. Thank you very much. One more question, the fellow at the end, he's had his hand up and I want to recognize him.
Well, thank you very much for bringing up the health care question. That was the question part, but I want to thank you so much for coming here because I've seen what your schedule is like, and I only have to believe that after being in Las Vegas yesterday in the UK earlier in the week, that you were going to be in Albany, New York on Sunday night. I do have something that's a little indicative of where the depth of your movement is going now. I have a feeling that when I left another gathering to come here this afternoon, I excused myself saying where I was going, and a combat vet from Vietnam who was in that gathering stood up and said to me, that is the only man that is honest and the only one that I would vote for. So I think you're following a little deeper than people get to try.
Thank you. Please go to thecynics.us. Sign up, help us out, help us help you. Let's unite America for peace and social and economic justice. Thank you.
Going through my mind